start just because everyone's quiet now, that it seems the appropriate time to start. So I'm Ashley, and I'm in Platypus, and I'm going to facilitate this evening. I guess just to kind of introduce Platypus, because it has a very silly name, for people who aren't familiar with it, is that our purpose as a group on the left is to question the state of the left today in light of its history and its present disintegration. And we try to seek clarification on the left meaning through discussion, debate, and disagreement. We do this work primarily at college campuses, and it takes the form of reading groups, film screenings, informal coffee breaks, and panel discussions like this one tonight. We also have brought this project into print, and there's a broadsheet over there for those of you who haven't seen called the Platypus Review that we publish for free. You can find it around U of T's campus. We have current copies of our latest issue, which we received in the mail from America today. Fancy that. And there's a lot of articles about Occupy Wall Street in that one. So tonight's event is the third we posted on the topic of reform, revolution, and resistance. The event was first thought up in November 2007 in Chicago, and like chiefly shaped around the anti-war movement at that time. So kind of we're revisiting it after Occupy to think through what those words and those ideas might mean to us today. And I guess just a point of order is that you might strongly agree or disagree with some of the points made by the panelists today, because we tried to have a broad array of voices. And what Platypus attempts to do is to hold a conversation in which the whole is more than the sum of its parts, in which certain disagreements amongst the panelists and amongst us, the audience, can potentially provide us with some light to consider what it means to be on the left today. So the event will go as follows. There'll be approximately a 5-minute opening remarks page for the panelists. Then we'll go to a Q&A session. And then afterwards, we want to be out of here by 9. And if we still want to talk, maybe we can go to the Regal Beagle. So I want to thank and introduce our panelists today. Speaking first will be Val Lin. She's a member of the Proletarian Revolutionary Action Committee and the Revolutionary Students Movement, and also a supporter of the RCP Canada. Next, speaking will be Megan, if you could wave. Megan has been active in environmental justice struggles, especially with regards to Canadian mining companies in Latin America. She's a journalist with the Toronto Media Co-op and panelist and participated in the Toronto G20 protests and Occupy Toronto as an organizer and journalist. She studied social anthropology at York and might get her MA if she can ever scrap up the back to a show.
Probably not.
After that, Jim will speak. Jim is an economist in the research department of the Canadian Auto Workers, Canada's largest private sector trade union. He received his PhD in economics in 1995 from the New School for Social Research in New York. He's also the author of books such as Paper Boom and co-editor of Challenging the Market, the struggle to regulate work and income. And after that, Claire will speak. Claire is a Toronto-based activist, writer, and volunteer coordinator for the Ontario Public Interest Research Group at the University of Toronto. Between 2007 and 2011, she served on the editorial committee of Upping the Ante, a journal of theory and action. Her publications include a chapter in Whose Streets, the Toronto G20, and the Challenges of Summit protests entitled What Moves Us Now, the Contradictions of Community. And speaking last will be Cam. He's an organizer for Platypus at U of T and a student of political science.
Organizer in a very loose sense of the word.
So starting off, Val Lin.
Okay, thank you for the introduction. I'm going to do what you did and do my self-promotional thing. As I said, I'm a supporter of the RCP. Our program is a sale for $2. We have People's War Digest 1, 2, and 3, which outlines our sort of strategy document. There's also bi-weekly free partisan papers that our members write for and distribute. And then one document called The Proletarian Movement We Need, which I'll explain. This is kind of the document on which my organization, the Proletarian Revolutionary Action Committee, was founded on. So thank you to the organizers for inviting me to speak on this panel tonight.
Can I interrupt you for just a second?
Yeah.
I just wanted to inform people that this event is being recorded, and that if anyone's uncomfortable during the Q&A, we can turn it off. That's cool?
No problem. So I hope that I represent the basics of our perspectives clearly and adequately in the 5 to 7 minutes allotted to me. I have divided my comments into two parts. The first is some preliminary reflections on the topic of this panel. Second introduces the vision and the political, ideological, and organizational practice we want to develop within the Proletarian Revolution Action Committee and its youth division, the Revolutionary Students Movement in Toronto. So I would like to start with a quote from Ulrich Meinhof of the Red Army faction, who loosely quoted Fred Hampton of the Black Panthers Party on his position on the American war in Vietnam in Berlin in May 1968. Quote, "Protest is when I say I don't like this and that. Resistance is when I see to it that things that I don't like no longer occur. Protest is when I say I will no longer go along with it. Resistance is when I see to it that no one else goes along with it anymore either." End quote. This quote invites us to evaluate the contemporary forms and expressions of resistance as seen in the new left movements of the late 60s, the anti-globalization movements of the late 90s, and of course the mass revolts we saw in 2011. Or mass uprisings. And so if we consider the tidal wave of mass uprisings, riots, and resistance from the Arab Spring to the Indignados movement in Spain to the workers' and popular class struggles against austerity in Italy, Portugal, Greece, and the London riots, and to the occupied movements right here in North America, to name only a few, we question to what extent these have been successful in ensuring that no one else goes along with it anymore. I think one of the main problems confronting the resistance movements today, and it's good to put the term resistance in quotes, that which prevents it from developing further and better is the constant slippage of resistance into reformism, whether deliberate or not. Despite the genuine will of people to resist the injustices meted out by the capitalist system, there's often the default recoil to the ideology and politics of social democracy. In the current attempts to resist austerity, this being the case in Canada. This is not to critique any particular group or sector, but it's a general assessment that behooves those of us that want to see the abolition of capitalism and its apparatuses of exploitation and repression to think through these contradictions between reformism and revolution. Certainly, we cannot dismiss efforts among the activists that are fighting to protect the gains that have been won by the working class and popular masses through hard-fought struggles in the past. For these are in the immediate interest of workers and people who are more and more impoverished as the crisis continues to unfurl. Yet it's been clear that during periods of crises, the bourgeoisie will find ways to consolidate in order to preserve its long-term interests and hegemony. Capitalism has proven itself adept in co-opting or neutralizing resistance, so the ruling class will make the minimal concessions necessary whenever it feels its interest and hegemony are seriously threatened. We need to understand that Keynesian economics has always worked in the service of the bourgeoisie. The industrialized imperialist states experienced a period of prosperity after World War II and were able to offer social benefits to their working and popular classes, thanks to the super profits which the bourgeoisie was able to extract from imperialist ventures in the Third World and pockets of the Third World in the First World. These resistance movements, often the embodiment and expression of the rage and frustration experienced by the exploited, marginalized, and oppressed in imperialist citadels, are constantly at risk of being co-opted by various forces representing different and competing class interests, whether they be trade union bureaucrats within the labor movement, mainstream bourgeois parties that claim to represent the interests of the workers, elements active inside the grassroots and community movements, and the rise of the NGO-type not-for-profit industries that rarely go beyond a politics of radical liberalism and reform. These forces, among others, contain and manage the widening contradictions in the belly of the beast, and in the service of the status quo by dragging the resistance back onto the legal and parliamentary terrain. They are incapable of producing radical, fundamental social transformations. I want to echo a comment made by the Parti Communiste Révolutionnaire, representative at the 3Rs panel in Halifax. The point perhaps is not about critiquing these resistance politics and those who refuse to go beyond them, but that the problem occurs when forces want to preserve the movement as it is, instead of pushing it further by developing a consistent framework and practice through which the revolutionary alternative will appear and gain the upper hand. This segues me into the next section of my commentary, so the second part of my presentation, having to do with our actual practice. We wouldn't be very good communists if, in the words of Mao Zedong, we have correct theory but merely prayed about it, pigeonhole it, and do not put it into practice. That theory, however good, is of no significance. Knowledge is acquired through practice and must then return to practice. I therefore submit a contentious claim for discussion that presently in Canada, in the categories set out by Meinhof, one cannot say there is resistance, but there are certainly protests. And this applies to those of us sympathetic to the RCP. I just also wanted to make clear that the absence of resistance does not apply to the Mohawk National Liberation Struggles in Conestataki in 1990s or any other protracted First Nation struggles in Caledonia and elsewhere. These are exceptions and cannot justifiably be categorized as Canadian. So we do have, we have seen an intensification of the people's struggle and an experience of that sort of struggle here in Canada, but it's not a Canadian phenomenon in contemporary times. As one of the founding members of the Proletarian Revolutionary Action Committee, a group of us attended the second Canadian Revolutionary Congress initiated by the RCP Canada, which, by the way, has no relation to the RCP USA. I should have stated that in the beginning. We work with the RCP Canada in developing a consistent and long-term framework for a communist theory and practice to generate this experience of proletarian struggle. It became evident for those of us in the PRAC that only by building a party, revolutionary and mass organizations, and a revolutionary united front that has a clear platform, that such a shift from protest to resistance can occur. Our aspirations, and we know the path ahead of us is long and foggy, is to build a true proletarian democracy that would necessitate the abolition of capitalism and which could advance the class struggle to achieve communism. Members of the PRAC are united on 4 points that aim to restart a new class struggle in Canada. So this is a document I was referring to at the beginning. It's called the Proletarian Movement We Need, and this outlines our basis of unity, which are by uniting proletarians across the country on the basis of breaking with bourgeois politics, on the basis of the revolutionary struggle against capitalism, and for the goal of communism, by supporting the struggles of the Native nations against the Canadian state, and by recognizing their unconditional right to self-determination. Third, by denouncing Canadian imperialism and its companies, which loot and destroy the peoples and resources of the oppressed countries through economic exploitation and war. And finally, by calling for the defeat of the imperialists all over the world, and by defending and supporting people's wars. The PRAC takes from the RCP program, the necessity of reaching that section of the working class that the PCR-RCP refers to as the hardcore of the proletariat. The nucleus of the potential revolutionary forces are to be found among the most exploited workers, immigrant and migrant labor, native proletarians, the youth of the proletariat, and doubly oppressed women. The social groups, according to Statistics Canada, facing the highest level of poverty are among the First Nations, the racialized minorities, and people with disabilities. We seek to reach into these sectors by applying the mass line because it is on their support and leadership within the party that will lead the proletarian struggle. In practical terms, PRAC, along with party units in Ottawa, Toronto, and the province of Quebec, launched a controversial campaign calling for the boycott of the 2011 federal elections. We went to proletarian neighborhoods with our bi-monthly newspaper to discuss with anyone willing to talk to us about their thoughts on the elections and what they would like to see. We explained our position and why we were calling for boycotts. Interestingly enough, within these pockets, we did receive praises and support. One older woman of color even told us that we should have started this campaign back in January. Interestingly enough, though, these were those that were the most opposed to our campaign were not those in reformist left organizations, although they were pretty upset with us, but surprisingly among those who identified as anarchists, socialists, or communists. Now, there are a lot of fruitful critiques of the campaign that we received from our friends and comrades, and many are correct in their criticisms, but on the whole, this campaign, we feel, helps educate us on how to apply the mass line in our political work and in the future. Our Revolutionary Students Movement members have been running monthly communist night schools to address contemporary issues and to help build a communist analysis from reading stuff you wouldn't normally read in school, stuff that comes from the international communist movement in addition to classic texts. Our attempt to build communist internationalism included a report back on the revolution in Nepal, a demo in front of the Indian embassy in Ottawa to denounce Operation Green Hunt, and to support the Maoist and Naxalite people's war there. And just recently, an event to promote and support the Communist Maoist Party of Afghanistan that are facing increasing attacks just recently in Panjwai, the massacre there. Our future campaigns will focus on the youth of the proletariat and connecting student struggles to the class struggles. Just recently, official unemployment rates for February in Canada remains at 7.6%. But among the youths aged 15 to 24, this rate more than doubles. It's at a staggering 14.6%. Here comprises the Reserve Army of Labor, where youths are assigned low-paid, low-skilled, and precarious part-time and split-shifts work, where they only get by, if that, considering the increased cost of living. Among those returning to school, students among the working class can expect enormous debt loads by the time they graduate. However, with no economic recovery in sight in the near future, we can expect that there will be some heating up of wide protests to which, among the PRAC exclaim, it is right to rebel, but we also add, it is necessary to build to resist.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really fun to be on this panel. I'm often on, like, panels of, like, communists sort of pretending to be liberals and talking about human rights, and it's nice to sort of be on a nice, explicitly sort of, like, you know, people aren't pretending to be things that they're
not.
That they're not, and I'm also not the craziest person here, apparently, which is also exciting.
Perhaps the most honest.
So Occupy Toronto, what was I doing at Occupy? So Occupy Toronto was, like, such a kind of insane experience, and I think people that have been involved in sort of, like, long-term political campaigns, like, if you think about something like the TP San 03 strike, where I know a lot of you from, like, looking back at it, it's hard to, like, actually, like, sometimes keep track of, like, everything that happened or what it was, right? And then, like, and for me, like, my interpretation on Occupy Toronto is, like, changed as, like, stuff has happened or whatever, but, like, so, I mean, the question is, like, so, anyway, so, specifically what I was doing at Occupy is I was sort of doing two things. One, I was sort of an occupier, and trying to bring sort of my politics, generally sort of anarcho-communist, you know, to Occupy a bit, and the other thing that I was doing was publishing a paper. So I'm with the Toronto Media Co-op, so what we did was we ended up doing, so we had a paper for the D20 called The Spoke. So anyway, this is a copy of The Spoke. And so basically what happened is we just, like, we sort of built on the fact that we had an organization that had done things, we'd had this history, and we were able to get out paper within the first day. And then we had basically a weekly paper, which was eventually, it became the official paper of Occupy Toronto. We eventually got funding from OPSU and CAW to help print our paper. And that was sort of it was kind of a broad leftist interest project in Occupy. Occupy is not, it's not exactly a leftist movement, and it's not quite correct to see it as such. It's not the same thing as the anti-globalization movement, because it involves, like, it definitely involves leftists, and I think that we did a fairly good job of coordinating with each other. Never have I worked with, like, anarchist communists, like Common Cause, like the IS, like environmental justice people, anyone vaguely left, like, ended up working together, because we ended up having a lot of points of unity, right? For instance, one of the points of unity that all the sort of leftists had was we were for the use of divisive language. People didn't want to use, like, divisive language. They wanted to talk about love. They wanted to drop the 99 versus the one line, and we sort of very strongly pushed for, like, inclusion of, you know, divisive language and, you know, divisive tactics. We were sort of always pushing the sort of tactical envelope, trying to take roads, you know, no, you don't need a permit to have a protest, these kinds of things. but another thing is that, like, by and large, the radical left didn't show up to Occupy Toronto, and this is apparently different from other cities, so I'm only going to be talking from sort of the Occupy Toronto perspective generally, but the radical left didn't show up generally, and so those of us who were on the left who did show up, we showed up sort of wanting to do sort of political work, and we ended up just doing, like, fair survival work, right? So we ended up being the people who we ended up being the people who created any kind of safety policies, right? Occupy people, there's a general sort of tendency towards, like, radical inclusion, but radical inclusion ends up being radically exclusive when you don't kick out, like, I don't know, big guys that attack women, or Nazis, or any of these things, right? So we had to sort of, like, try to attempt to deal with that, right? Also, like, huge amount of like mental health problems, some sort of, you know, and a homeless population, which overlaps somewhat with mental health and drug issues. And some like homeless people and mentally ill people were able to really participate in Occupy, and they became like key occupiers, and it was like incredibly therapeutic for them. And like there was like one fairly young guy who just got like really into it, and you know, sort of found accepting communities for the first time. But some people like just were huge problems and would have trouble existing in any society. And it was really difficult at Occupy to try to like strike a kind of balance, right? Especially given the sort of like lack of cohesion. So yeah, I mean, like, so one of the things about Occupy that was great was that it kind of brought like revolution in a sense back on the table. You didn't necessarily hear the word revolution that much, but like Occupy was not about reformist demand. They were not into reformist demand. Occupy, they were generally kind of, some people came with the Robin Hood tax, and people from Occupy were kind of suspicious of that, right? They're suspicious of sort of slick PR campaigns. They have a sort of natural suspicion of political parties. So it's kind of interesting. I think Fightback came down and had in some ways more success just talking straight communism than you did talking NDP, right? Which is like not necessarily like how it always happens, right? But then you ended up getting in like weird, crazy conversations with people, like about like cell phones and how cell phones are destroying like human society or something, right? Like just stuff that like wouldn't necessarily sort of fit into like what I consider a political spectrum, because you just have like new people and like coming with ideas. Some of these ideas were really stupid. So I've talked about radical inclusion. They also have this thing about no leaders at Occupy. But as we know, when you have horizontal organizing without structure, some kinds of structures, you get leaders. You just don't know who those leaders are. Those leaders are unaccountable, right? I think we've all, probably everyone in this room accepts the sort of like need to have either A, leaders, or B, a very well-organized horizontal structure that can actually work. Occupy had none of those things, so you ended up having these crazy fiefdoms. So there was like the Kingdom of Food, which was like, which was basically run like by this like really kind of like Machiavellian but really good organizer guy, right? And so he ended up having sort of his own goon squad. He controlled the food. If he didn't like something at Occupy, he would take the food team on strike. It was really bizarre, right? Similarly, logistics ended up controlled by a sort of similar, like, but like more subtle. Like this guy was more of a hippie instead of being as openly Machiavellian, so he never came under the same kind of like social problems. But like logistics was run as an insane fiefdom. Media was the most ineffective media thing that I've ever seen or been involved with. They were very, like, I remember once me and Chris Langkraut from Rabble almost got kicked out of the media tent. It was actually very hard for us to get into the media tent because they're like, you guys are corporate media. We're like, no, we're Rabble and Media Co-op. Like, we're not even paid. Like, we're so not corporate media. And they were just so completely ineffective that by the end of Occupy and Eviction, Media Co-op was actually the only people that had teams on the ground with cameras, with video cameras. We had shifts. Like, we were organized. And we were the only people that actually covered the eviction, other than Livestream, which was basically two guys who had a computer who were, like, totally unaccountable to anything. And so Livestream ended up, I mean, the joke is that Livestream was all about chemtrails and stuff like that. So it was basically an incredibly insane experience. But if you think, but it was also, like, insanely popular. Like, I would go around, I would talk to people about Occupy. I got two free cab rides. Cab drivers were just, like, refused to take our money and then started talking about their own labor issues, sort of their own lives, you know. One guy, like, was saying how he came here from, I can't remember what country he was from now, but, like, how he came to this country as an immigrant and he's never been able to afford to have children and how lucky he is not to have children and how pathetic that was that he was lucky. Like we were really able to, like, talk to working class people about Occupy. Students, like, it was just a hugely popular thing, and, like, I'm not used to being part of popular protest movements. you know, like, QP 1903, not the most popular strike in the entire world. G20, like, that was kind of in the middle, right? But Occupy was sort of generally popular, and it was sort of a general, like, a genuine sort of expression of, like, revolutionary ideas. regarding like resistance and reform, I mean, there is resistance in Canada. I mean, not just in Native communities, but I think resistance, you know, takes the form of like fighting back against austerity, right? I mean, in the first world, it's not about, you know, fighting for the 8-hour day or whatever, right? Like, it's about, you know, fighting. It's about fighting to maintain what we have, right? Which obviously we have a lot because it's the first world, and so I think that that's sort of where the resistance comes in. But I also want to talk about another, like, other than reform and revolution, like another Rosa Luxemburg, the mass strike. I think there's a lot of parallels between what we're seeing with, you know, Occupy specifically in North America, but then also sort of generally Arab Spring, to, you know, the sort of mass strike movements that Luxemburg described in Russia, right, prior to, you know, and during the 1905 revolution. And what these are sort of spontaneous things that arise, right? And the party doesn't call them, nobody calls them, they just happen, right? And I think that the radical left has to be ready to take advantage of things as they happen, because we can't make things happen, right? Like, we can't necessarily call it, and we have to be willing to have that kind of spontaneity. But we also have to have organizations, right? And I don't think that organization necessarily has to look like a vanguard party, but organizations are critical. The fact that, like, Common Cause was on the ground at Occupy was the only reason I could be at Occupy without getting physically beat up, right? I actually got in a fight with, like, a 7-foot-tall man for holding an anarcho-communist flag and sort of defending, like, anarchism in general, right? And the only thing that allowed me to be there was the contacts and the organizations that I had made previously who, like, sort of literally had my back in a very real way. And, I mean, Media Co-op, we were able to be actually effective. We were able to coordinate with Montreal. We were able to coordinate cross-country, have a website. And you have to set these things up in the slow time so that, you know, when you actually need them, they're actually there. So, yeah, anyway, I could talk about Occupy forever. But, yeah, so, anyway. Yeah, and, I mean, if we don't show up, we don't get to have a voice, right? It's not enough to criticize Occupy from outside to say, oh, Occupy has shitty race politics. Oh, Occupy, you know, has it's a bad word. Oh, Occupy, you know, they suck, right? Like, nobody's going to listen to us, right? We're only talking to each other. If we don't go out into the world, you know, into where sort of mass struggle is happening, then it's useless, and we may as well be just a talking shop. The end.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for the invitation. This is very interesting for me. I didn't know what Platypus was all about before, so this is a learning experience, as are the other speakers on the panel, and that's awesome. I will apologize in advance. I have to leave at 8:15. I had a family situation. I got to go pick up my 2 kids, one of whom, her middle name is Rosa, named after Rosa Parks and Rosa Luxemburg. So you know where I stand on reform and revolution. Namely, we need both, which always struck me as an eminently sensible approach to the whole thing. I'll use that to sort of frame my comments tonight. I do want to recognize the fine work that all of the other groups and movements here, OFERG, Occupy, labor movement, student campaigns, every one of them is vital. And my main view in life is just to encourage as much activism and fight back and radicalism on virtually any issue in any space we can, because if there's one thing that we are missing, I mean, we all have to sharpen our political analysis and our understanding, but what we're really missing is people to get off their friggin' butts and go out and demand something. And I think the rest of it, as we start doing that, will take care of itself. So thank you to all of you for what you're doing. And Megan, don't worry about scraping up money for an MA. After what you went through at Occupy, you got an MA in life.
I already had that.
Yeah. My views on reform and revolution are that you mobilize people, you connect them, you engage them by confronting some immediate grievance, problem, evil that they confront in their day-to-day life. I've never met somebody who just sprang from zero to an all-rounded systemic critique of capitalism and why it needs to be abolished. The masses of people who engage in struggle do so motivated by concrete experiences of their life. And that's where all of our issue-oriented campaigns for justice, for inclusion, for environmental sustainability, for rights in the workplace, for neighborhoods, are all entry points where we can capture someone's imagination and engage them in a fight for change that initially starts out very concrete and incremental and small in a way. But that's how you motivate them as individual activists. And that's how you encourage their capacity and their willingness to demand something different. Through that engagement, I believe, they have the potential to learn more about the system, understand that the particular problem that they're confronting is not unique and has deeper roots, deeper causes, and will require more fundamental solutions, ultimately. So they broaden out their analysis into something potentially, if they're given the opportunity and the tools and the education and the experience, into a broader and more systemic critique. I also think there's another way in which fighting for reforms, those incremental changes, those specific pragmatic demands that we make of the system, trains them, and that is to learn about their own power and their capacity to affect change. As they learn about that and experience it and build it, then we have the potential awareness and consciousness of exercising that power in more fundamental ways. So as we're fighting for those things, though, we do need the broader holistic systemic critique of it. And I am very much a believer. I think this was a Rosa Luxemburg approach as well, of having a minimum program and a maximum program, in the sense of a list of concrete, incremental, ultimately reformist demands that we're fighting for, but motivated and organized and understood through the lens of a critical understanding of the systemic nature of the problem that we're facing. In my work as an economist, I understand that in the sense of fighting both for incremental changes in economic policy that would make people's lives better today, but at the same time trying to highlight the ways in which people are fundamentally hobbled in their economic lives and hence in their human lives by the way that capitalism works as a system. So in my, I'm not plugging this book, I'm just mentioning it. In my book, Economics for Everyone, which was intended as an economics textbook for activists, I have a chapter 26, which is a minimum program, and I have a chapter 27, which is a maximum program. Chapter 26 talks about what I think would be a or an internally consistent list of demands that would make capitalism more livable and a better place. And if you look at the range of experience in capitalism in the world today, I don't accept for a minute the argument that none of that is possible, because the reality is there are big differences in different types of capitalism, and we should be fighting for better treatment from the bosses in addition to fighting for something bigger. My chapter 27 is the beginnings of a maximum program, which talks about how could you organize economic life outside of the assumptions and structures of capitalism. What are some of the alternatives, ways that you could organize production, organize investment, organize innovation, organize work? And there's no recipe there. If there was a recipe, we wouldn't be in the mess that we're in today in the world. It's going to be a learning experience, but it's important to have that range, that window, as we're fighting for all the other things, to be thinking bigger. Otherwise, we'll lose the potential for that systemic challenge. The organizers originally asked me to talk about the similarities and differences between the Occupy movement and the New Politics Initiative. So I'll just take a couple of minutes on that, because I think that was part of the thought process of having me here. The New Politics Initiative, for those that don't know, was a political initiative started just around the turn of the century. It was organized around the NDP's internal structural review. At that point, the NDP was very weak in the parliamentary world, had kind of lost its sort of momentum, was almost losing its official party status, so it launched this big renewal process that was culminating in a special convention in the fall of 2001. While the NDP had no energy, the left had lots of energy then. That was the peak of the anti-globalization movement. The whole trend towards extra-parliamentary activism rather than electoral focus, and a flowering of different kinds of activist and political initiatives on the left. So the idea for the NPI came from a group of people, some who were members of the NDP, some like myself who were not, who said this is the moment to propose a different idea of how to organize politically. And we proposed that the NDP join with other left forces to form a new, more movement connected, political party. And we got support from a range, a very broad range actually, from Greens and Liberals to revolutionaries, to some folks in the NDP, some folks out, for that concept. In a way, riding the coattails of the hope and activism of the anti-globalization movement. That particular project failed because the NPI idea was defeated by about a 2-to-1 margin at the NDP convention. For a while, with that whole World Social Forum area of organizing and so on, some of those ideas carried on. But there wasn't sort of a structured or compelling enough core to the idea, and there were differences as to whether we should work within the party or not within the party, and so on. So the NPI just kind of faded away. But I think that that core vision of a political movement that combines electoralism with activism, that combines a minimum program with a maximum program, that core vision is still important, and I ultimately think still valid. And there's some elements of that in the Occupy work that has happened that was so important. Despite all the problems around the politics and the organization of Occupy movement, which Megan has spoken of, we can't lose sight of the overwhelming importance of their success in claiming the moral and symbolic vision, focusing attention on inequality and exclusion and how negative that's been. And I think it's a challenge for all of us to think, how can we do more of that? How can we connect the different struggles that are here? And how can we connect our reformist vision with our bigger vision? So that's my take on it. And again, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for having me. I'm recovering from a cold, so if I burst out hacking very attractively, I apologize. Very interesting to be on this panel so far, and curious about the discussion. Maybe I'll let the difference between what I've produced here speak for itself. So I want to start with the concepts themselves, reform, revolution, and resistance, and kind of state from the outset that all of them exist in a world defined by existing relations of power. One of the premises, and that the question for us in this room is what is the best strategy for materially changing those relations of power. So the first thing I noticed about the three concepts when I got the invitation is that two of them, reform and resistance, are defined in direct reference to constituted power. We reform constituted power. We resist constituted power. Revolution, in contrast, by definition, refers to the entire constituted field. So I'll get into my thoughts about resistance, which is what I understand that the focus of this panel to be. But I think it's first valuable to highlight a related distinction which kind of immediately came to mind when I sat down to think about this, and that's French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. That's a distinction between the revolutionary and the rebel, wherein, in my mind, the habits of reform and resistance would be aligned with the latter of the rebel. So in this isn't a critique of Baudelaire, this aristocratic French poet. Sartre explains, quote, "The revolutionary wants to change the world. He transcends it and moves toward the future, toward an order of values which he himself invents. The rebel is careful to preserve the abuses from which he suffers so that he can go on rebelling against them. He does not want to destroy or transcend the existing order. He simply wants to rise up against it. In the depths of his heart, he preserves the rights which he challenges in public, and if they disappeared, his own raison d'être would disappear with them." So in this formulation, the rebel, by definition, requires constituted power in order to exist. And therefore, although the rebel's motivations may be radical in orientation, like they may orient to the root of social problems, the strategy of rebellion entails preservation of the status quo. So again, in contrast, revolution, insofar as it demands transformation of the entire constituted field, ultimately demands abolition of society as a whole, as it's constituted, including self-abolition of radical forces as they're currently constituted. So
So this doesn't mean, of course, and I think you, a bunch of people have already kind of gotten at this, that, that rebels and revolutionaries don't find themselves advancing similar tactical messages or propositions at any given moment. But it does mean that their respective methods of devising and implementing a strategy are distinct, and therefore they likely come into conflict quite regularly. So I thought I'd just highlight an example. I know this is a rather abstract talk. So Slavoj Žižek, who's a Slovenian Marxist philosopher, wrote a kind of controversial review for the London Review of Books in 2007, criticizing Simon Critchley, who's an American continental philosopher, criticizing his book, Infinitely Demanding. Has anybody read that book? Has anybody read the review? Was it less controversial than I thought? Okay. So under the title, the book review is titled Resistance is Surrender. Žižek argued that Critchley's advocacy of a proliferation of resistance is simply, quote, the obverse of accepting the triumph of capitalism. So the, you know, two sides of the same coin. So in Žižek's estimation, resistance refers to everyday, and I know that this was highlighted also in the description of the event, everyday acts against state power that involve, quote, withdrawing from its terrain and creating new spaces outside of its control. So this word prioritized, again, quote, bombarding the state with impossible demands, denouncing the limitations of state mechanisms. The main argument for conducting the politics of resistance at a distance from the state hinges on the ethical dimension of the infinitely demanding call for justice. No state can heed this call since its ultimate goal is the real political one of ensuring its own reproduction, its economic growth, public safety, etc. So I think if we analyze these premises of resistance or a politics of resistance in which the disavowal of efforts to seize state power figure quite prominently, we see that it does not entail a dedication to undermining the conditions that permit resistance to exist in the first place. I know that sentence sucks. But in simple terms, and this is why I use Sartre in the first place, the rebel cannot exist without that against which she rebels. So Sartre's conception of self-abolition as a premise of revolutionary politics here coincides directly with Marx, who writes, the proletariat cannot liberate itself without destroying the conditions of its own life, but it cannot do that without destroying all the inhuman conditions of life in contemporary society which exist in the proletariat in a concentrated form. The premise of self-abolition also arises in feminist and anti-colonial theory. For example, Andrea Dworkin's perhaps most clear example is her book Woman Hating, or Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth, in which both of them envision societies wherein the categories of woman and the colonized subject, respectively, are abolished through the production of a new kind of human. So if we accept that revolution demands self-abolition, what does that mean for social movements of resistance today? And I was invited to speak on this panel because of my involvement writing an editorial about the Black Bloc during the G20 here in Toronto in 2010. It was published in Upping the Ante. And given that I only have 5 minutes to speak, I'm going to try to limit the rest of my comments to an extremely brief and unfortunately inevitably reductive summary of that argument and try to analyze how it fits into the three others, because I wanted to respect that that was the basis of the invitation. So in the editorial, we propose that if radicals can bring ourselves to temporarily set aside deliberations about the strategic admissibility of the Black Bloc, and Black Bloc tactics, we see that Black Bloc, and more importantly, intermovement responses to it, reveal really important things about the character of movements today. Specifically, I think in the aftermath of the Black Bloc actions, we saw two primary reactions from the constituted left that is dominated by social democrats and then social movement radicals in the case of that mobilization. The former, so the social democratic left, comprising mainly organized labor, disavowed the bloc
in an effort to preserve its own legitimacy and its seat at the table. So this would probably fall most clearly into the reform category. In contrast, social movements and social movement radicals in particular defended the actions of the Bloc by claiming that expressions of rage against the state, in this case in the form of property destruction, are legitimized by the violence of the state itself, full stop. So a few things I think become clear. One, most of us are extremely unsure of how we might truly engage in revolutionary action in our contemporary context. Two, in the absence of clarity on this front, a lot of radicals, that is, people, again, who are orienting to the root of problems and are anti-capitalists or claim to be anti-capitalists, Israelis, tend to valorize resistance as kind of like almost as a placeholder, like the thing we're doing until the conditions for revolution actually arise. And moreover, I think this opposition seems to be more and more integrated into the logic of the commodity forum, the logic of capitalism itself, particularly insofar as the core aim seems to be to like shock the fucking status quo out of people through distinguishing ourselves through consumption. So consumption of different things that are not the status quo. So that's two. Do people remember I was doing numbers? Okay, three. The movement's practices that are closest to revolution, actually, in certain ways, and this is, again, wish that I had more time, but let's say the Black Bloc, insofar as it features commitment to abolishing existing conditions, including the constituted left in a way, in the effort to produce something new, fall extremely fucking short. And specifically, the Bloc is maybe the limit situation of that politics of resistance that orients foremost to representations of revolution, not revolution and revolutionary method itself. So, of course, I don't think any of this analysis makes strategy any more self-evident, and I'm probably equally skeptical about anybody who like proposes a way forward. But I do think that movement activists in general and communist anarchists in their collaboration would be better off adopting at least the following premises. So one, we know our work is consequential when we're producing conflicts, and I think we can produce, producing conflicts that allow us to envision actually becoming a dual force against constituted power. And two, as long as our priority is to preserve ourselves as we're currently constituted, specifically in allowing our work to be subordinated so much to the logic of commodity, then whatever our kind and good intentions, we're at very high risk of resigning ourselves to principled debate.
Okay. I'm Cam Hardy. I'm an organizer for Platypus here in Toronto. And Claire already did half my talk for me.
Oh, shit.
No, it's good. So if you're like me and you read the far left press as much as possible, you already know that the old question of reform or revolution still weighs heavily on the minds of many people, although some of them seem to think that they solved this years ago. Contemporary issues like the Occupy movement and the G20 protests are invariably framed in these historical terms, which were forged within the early debates within social democracy. Critics of the vandalism that took place during the G20 summit, for example, were characterized as reformists, compared to the anarchist revolutionaries who sought provocations with the police and shunned associations with the traditional left of the trade unions and the NDP. A more absurd example of this tendency to understand the present through the lens of old historical debates can be seen in the Spartacist League, who are sadly not here tonight, who described their brief support for U.S. troops in Haiti as being akin to the German Social Democrats betraying their principles and supporting World War I. Little perspective. I'd like to suggest that to categorize leftist politics today as reformist or revolutionary misses how all these approaches, in fact, share a resignation to perpetual resistance of one form or another. The choice today is not whether you're for reform or revolution, but over tactical disputes about how best to resist, whether in parliament or in the streets. The question of peaceful versus violent tactics, or organization versus spontaneity, mm-hmm. misses something essential, which is what the changes we strive for are actually attempting. In the late 1960s, the Polish Marxist Leszek Kolakowski would note that the right has nothing but tactics. So how are we to consider a left whose only question is over the tactics of resisting capitalism rather than overcoming it? Kolakowski was writing at a transition between the old communist and socialist left that was formalized in the 1920s and 30s and the attempt to resituate revolutionary politics in the 1960s, the time of the new left. The left, he concludes, is not a tactical question of how best to resist, but primarily a fermenting factor or process of revealing the possibilities for social transformation that continually arise under capitalism. The left, in other words, by its theory and political practice, does not merely knock doors for the NDP or smash windows in a black bloc. For Kolakowski, the left would only do such things and would in turn be recognizable as left because they allow it to grasp the real possibilities to transform society, which prevents people from otherwise living more freely than they should. When this panel was conceived, we in Platypus had the pamphlet Reform or Revolution by Rosa Luxemburg in mind. This pamphlet looked to characterize a crisis that was emerging in social democracy in Germany over the question of how capitalism might be transformed and through social democratic working class politics. Luxemburg did not argue against reforms per se, but rather against a reformist trend that was emerging within her party, in which revolution was deemed to be not only impossible, but even unnecessary and undesirable. Despite appearances, though, unfortunately we cannot reduce contemporary social democrats to the reformists of the old days, any more than Luxemburg can be understood as the ancestor of the Black Bloc and other ultra-left groups today. This is because neither the NDP nor the Black Bloc have any sense of the possibilities that go unrealized in capitalism today in a way that Luxemburg, or even old reformist social democracy of her time, did. It's important to note that reformism today and reformism of old mean something completely different. The old reformists, for all their problems, still sought to do away with capitalism, albeit through gradual changes rather than revolution. The obvious example here is the Regina Manifesto of the CCF, the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, which famously called for the eradication of capitalism even through parliamentary measures. This is obviously a pretty far cry from the NDP's recent debate about whether to keep the words democratic socialism in the party constitution. What we consider reformism today, then, is at best an attempt to preserve whatever of the welfare state survived the neoliberal 1980s and 90s. This is the sort of parliamentary resistance offered by the NDP. I'm going to keep things short, so a last point I'd like to consider is the blind spot generated by the predominance of resistance that's particularly disabling in our moment. Resistance engenders a sense that all organized forms of politics can only be considered as hopelessly problematic and inevitably subject to co-option by outside forces. This takes the form of meet the old boss, same as the new boss cynicism. Assuming that everyone will inevitably sell out if they attempt to grasp power, the solution is often considered to forge an alternative in the present instead of opting to engage with the system. This has resulted in a prevailing sense that rather than consider what might be possible and grasp at it with all our might, the focus is on democratic procedures above all. Political understanding is to be drawn immediately from everyday life or from nowhere at all. This does not organize over political interventions with respect to where they might have the largest effect, but to shape the world to our, but shapes the world instead to our political inventions. The prevailing idea is that politics should prefigure the society that we want to create, and that we can be the change we want to see in the world in the way of Gandhi. This reduces politics to an ethical notion that change on a personal level is the best we can get today. Resistance obscures what's new in the present, then. We simply mobilize and demobilize, never learning what the defeats mean, subjecting ourselves to ongoing regression. We appear to continually find ourselves behind the curve, being caught by surprise, subjected to an ongoing hope that circumstances will eventually become bad enough that our preconceived political forms will find a hearing by the general public. To this end, we in Platypus feel now it's time to take nothing for granted on the left. Rather than look to the past for blueprints, overlooking past failures and the passage of time itself, we seek to work through this problematic history. Through panels such as the one tonight, we want it to become clear to those on the left and to our audience how the past continues to haunt us and block our ability to move. To put it another way, we take the failures of the past left not as a way to dismiss its current relevance, but as the only way to break through the past, allowing the left to rise to the challenges that the Occupy movement presents.
So I guess if any of the panelists have comments that you'd like to make to each other, like very briefly.
I think we should start with questions.
Or wait, Jim, do we want to start with questions?
Jim's got to go.
Okay, that sounds good. I have one if no one else has one.
I'm
mine was like prompted primarily by Jim, but I guess, I mean, like all the top. I want to actually really thank the panelists because I thought that all the presentations were really thoughtful, which is always kind of a scary thing that they might not be. something like this. But particularly I was taken aback by kind of your mapping that the way to kind of produce like a larger left is through, you know, like this sort of progressive track to a systemic critique, that you have to start where someone, like where someone is, and then, you know, push that a little further, a little further. And I just kind of wanted to kind of ask what you thought of like the regressive possibility of that too, because obviously, like, after all, the right is chiefly comprised of the 99% as well, who have experiences with capitalism on a day-to-day basis, too, and are brutalized by it, and yet they don't become more progressive or more leftist through these experiences. So what is necessary to kind of curate people's encounters with the world in order to kind of push them in a more progressive or left map? But it's not directly just towards Jim, but any of the panelists, I guess.
Okay. Well, I was thinking of when somebody gets involved in a movement. When someone's involved in a movement for some kind of progressive change, it could be an environmental movement, it could be the peace movement, it could be an equity-seeking movement, it could be their union. They are already taking a stand that something's wrong in the current system, and we have to improve it through some kind of progressive, in general, reformist demand. That was how personal. That's how I got involved in politics. I got involved in the peace movement, the Latin American Solidarity Movement. And then that's when I started, first of all, understanding political activism and the need to fight for change rather than just being an individual out there. And then that's where I met lefties of various stripes so I could get exposure to a range of ideas, including systemic critiques. And then that was when I became a socialist rather than somebody who was fighting against cruise missile testing. I've just dated myself, haven't I? Cruise missile testing debate. About 180 years ago. So I think it's not just, I don't accept the idea that somebody being brutalized by capitalism is automatically going to end up as a progressive, not remotely. I'm saying when somebody takes the first step to say, oh, there's an issue I care about, I'm going to do something about it. That's when we've got the opportunity to hook them in and, first of all, encourage and nurture that activism, but secondly, train it and broaden it to something more systemic than that issue-oriented demand. I think that's what I was trying to say.
I don't know if anyone else wants to kind of touch on this.
Yeah, well, I think that I would argue sort of against that and say that the strength of Occupy and why people really felt drawn to Occupy was that sort of lack of reformist demand, because there's so many sort of little single issue reformist demand campaigns, and there's a lack of sort of broader thinking about like what the world could look like, right? So like although Occupy was sort of trapped in like weird kind of utopian socialist thing, people did get to think about and try to make a bit of a world that they wanted to live in, which is like I think something that we on the left have like sometimes like we've gotten so stuck on the reform that we forget even to talk about revolution sometimes. And I think that, like, we need to balance that.
I agree.
I guess my comment would be to place all these movements within history. What you suggested, Jim, kind of to me sounds like the reformist thesis of understanding history that, you know, there's this natural progression towards a better society through incremental, gradualist changes. A comrade of mine was saying that, you know, this is part of an opportunist strategy to get more people on your side by plucking the low-hanging fruit. So in that sense, it strikes me, like, when we proceed, history never moves in sort of that kind of progressive regression. that I understand it. There's always turning points, there's always leaps and bounds that introduce new problems, new contradictions in front of, you know, revolutionary forces or the people. So for me, I guess, I mean, I don't want to give the impression that I'm saying that we shouldn't fight for reforms. Like, it's something that, because of a lack of a clear strategy to identify who our enemy is, right? Like, I'm not certain that within Occupy itself that we had a basis of a class unity or the ability to identify who the enemy is. The fact that we had police at first cooperating with the movement and then general public support generally, you know, compare that to the Black Blockers, who I think are maybe within the context of more revolutionary action, despite its disorganization and its lack of strategy, it's pure tactics, right? So for me, I think there's a danger in conceptualizing history that way. I think we need to place all these movements I am a Leninist. We do follow dialectical materialism and see, you know, what were these fighting organizations of the oppressed classes. What can we learn from those defeats and failures? What can we learn from those revolutionary struggles that actually had fight still in them? And we don't see that among the established left today. That would be my response.
Okay, I'm going to take three people's names that have had a few questions.
Can I respond?
Of course, yes.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do questions at other time.
Go ahead.
Oh, sure. I thought you were like later. Yeah. I really appreciate the, I think, what my impression or my take on what you're trying to advance, which is the the necessity of us talking about pedagogy internally and how we orient to people who are going to be joining the movements. And I think you touched on this a lot, and I agree with you, that people are going to get involved for all kinds of reasons, and our role is to push certain conclusions as far as they can go. So, yeah, people get involved, and they have all their main assumption is that the state and capitalism are kind of the things you're not going to imagine abolishing. And so their concerns or personal frustrations and lived experiences may lead them eventually and quite easily to feel very differently and begin strategizing around that. And I think that's kind of the role. The question, and I feel like that happens on an individual level, and the thing that worries me most about the kind of activistism about, you know, like, what we just need to do is, like, get people in the streets and into forums where they could be deliberating about this shit, is that we maybe lose sight of what it would mean to aim higher and say, how do we reach more people simultaneously? How do we produce conditions for, a mass, and of course, my eggs in the basket of the working class, but a mass response to the status quo that's like, no, we can overthrow this. And I feel, and of course this is, well, maybe we'll get to it. I feel like the element, just because I saw Josh like roll his eyes so far back in his head, the element of the Black Bloc, that was the healthy banter. The element of the Black Bloc that I think people I kind of fairly conceive of as a revolutionary attribute is that it's trying to do that. It's trying to intervene at a material level to produce a rupture in like mass consciousness. And okay, I saw more than three hands, so I'm going to take Josh. I got your name from Creative Commons, which is helpful. Then I saw Riley. Your name's correct?
Barry.
Next to Barry.
Yes.
Dan? All boys.
And
Joseph. Joseph? Okay.
Peter, and I think we jumped
in. Neil?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay, I'm just going to take those seven for now. We'll see if we get them to them. Okay, so Josh?
Okay, my thoughts were collected earlier, but now. Together. I was struck, I mean, also with what Thousand and Claire were saying, and kind of connects to this. I was struck with what Camp ended on about this past continuing to haunt us, and I want to structure around that because I do agree that the past does continue to haunt us, but only because we don't learn from both the successes and failures of the past. And I feel one of the issues that comes up, talked again and again on these panels in Toronto, that I've seen for 17 years in the movement, and I am older than I am.
That's almost as old as cruise missile testing.
Yeah. But you know, what I've seen is that, you know, we aren't really discussing what the reasons for actual failure and the reasons for actual success, and there's this fetishism for kind of like reinventing the wheel over and over, even though the wheels we're trying to reinvent are things that have already been attempted and have failed. So, I mean, a number of things that I would question is, like, should we be aiming all our energy at fighting for reform as leftists when social democrats already do this? Masses deserve more from us, right? Secondly, around remembering things, and I think you brought it up against the Black Bloc, maybe the reason that I partially rolled my eyes is I feel, again, the same discussion of the Black Bloc comes up, but people forget that actually the most successful events that get called the Black Bloc were the Red Bloc. And the SCAA, when I was there, the Red Bloc, which were former socialist axiom, or axiom socialist action here, people, their idea of tactics was that they would bring the masses to a specific target to do something, and they were much more successful. In fact, I was struck and radicalized by them and not by the Black Bloc. And they brought people into it, right? They didn't confuse people with it. And I feel that kind of brings us closer to, like, something more towards, like, an actual, you know, I don't know, like a contact with, like, against state powers and like the Black Bloc does, and I think we need to think about that. But
can you try to, was there a question?
The whole thing is just about, like, should we be fighting for, you know, better treatment as leftists when social democrats already do this for us, and this thing about the not learning from the mistakes of the past, and then I, you know, just mention the Black Bloc.
Okay, so if anyone wants to respond to that, and then I will remind the people in the audience, I'm going to cut you off after like a minute, and there better be a question hidden in there. There was one in your case. I'm not making a bad example of your name.
Yeah. Maybe take more than one question.
Sure. Yeah. Do you want me to take another question?
Yeah, like maybe
okay,
like
cool.
Three questions.
Riley?
Something otherwise, I think.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. Everybody knows now. My name is Riley. Another left group of many left tendencies represented here called the International Bolshevik Tendency. And less afraid to sort of put it out there because there are so many here. I think a lot of us were inviting a bunch of people over here to talk about things on the left because I think that what the left really needs is discussion of ideas. I think that part of what Josh was saying is really great, is that it's just about, for example, you know, reasons for actual failure and reasons for actual success. We can all say, or we all know that, yes, the left is very small. Yes, there are very few people who are advocating making a revolution. We get it. You know, we already feel bad enough about ourselves. Now let's see why exactly we are, where we are today, and let's see how we can go forward, how we can win. You know, and I think that there are groups and there are voices who try to put forward more or less success with more or less accuracy, you know, crazy sectarian way. And I think that instead of saying that, well, you know, we haven't succeeded in reinventing people of one's ideas, we have to say, what ideas are good, and build a group around them. I think we all know that's what we have to do, because there have been a group in history that have been able to unite the working class, more or less, and the press around a revolutionary program. And I think despite the title of the forum tonight, which I think is a good title, I feel most people in the room, most people on the left, even people, you know, who I might characterize as reformists, can all agree abstractly that we want a revolution. You know, reform, resistance, and revolution. These are all things that exist. We all want a revolution. You know, but I think we have to understand that wanting a revolution doesn't necessarily make revolutionary politics. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll finish up. And I think that what's going to determine revolution, what's going to determine making a revolution, what determines revolutionary politics is largely our approach to these questions of reform and resistance. Good question. I don't necessarily agree with the comrade from the RCP on the idea, you know, that there is a resistance in Canada unless you're Aboriginal. I think that working class people do resist. They want to resist. They do it more or less effectively. Reform, just to quickly touch on something that the comrade was saying, you know, minimum maximum program, I don't really think Rosa Luxemburg is there, because already imposing minimum maximum, you're separating, by definition, you're separating your program into two things. You're pursuing something that is explicitly not revolutionary, it's not inviting people along non-revolutionary politics. But I don't really think that's what the likes of work this morning is going to get. I think she was pretty explicitly opposed to that.
Okay, I'm going to go to Barry now.
Okay. Thank you.
I actually have a question, putting it out there.
Yeah.
I won't make a speech. You can ask your question after I make my speech.
Yeah. We don't ask questions anymore.
Well, good evening, and I thank the organizers for facilitating this meeting, this discussion. I think it's all too infrequent, and more of this kind of exchange would be useful. I want to address the question that was posed here a moment ago. For defeat, or rather, I think more accurately, having a sense of our own proportion here, the reason for the decline of the left, I think, is due to the failure of working class leadership.
Mm-hmm.
I think the leadership of the mass organizations has basically put their membership to sleep over the past 30 years,
mm-hmm.
which meant that when the ruling class had no choice but to turn up the heat and increase the demands for give-backs, there was no readiness to fight back. And there was even a forgetfulness about how to fight back. And I think that's not the result of the errors of the micro-left. I think that's the result of a much larger forces in play. And I think also the dispute here that we're discussing is not just between those who want to be active in the parliamentary arena versus those who want to be active in the streets. Because amongst those who want to be active in the streets, there are plenty of disputes. For example, those who have a utopian perspective. Let's turn our neighborhood, our workplace, our community, our occupation into an ideal community. That's not realistic. The co-op movement, not against co-ops, but as a strategy, it's a failure. The idea of workers' control, which if generalized, can be a genuine challenge to the larger system. The point is to avoid substitutionist politics, where in order to electrify the working class, the way some in the 19th century, like Bakunin and Blanqui, argued, you have to acts of political violence, as opposed to those who want to engage, mobilize, and empower the working class. The idea, I have to agree with the last speaker, and that is the distinction between a minimum program and a maximum program, or between reform and revolution, is highly problematic. I think that divorce between the two that creates a dichotomy that is very anti-dialectical, and it's really the enemy of change. The key lies in, I don't claim to have the code to this lock, but I think the key lies in finding a way to effect a transitional program, not a minimum versus a maximum program, but a transitional program.
Okay, I'm going to have to ask the questioner boss.
Don't you agree? No. Okay, I'll just conclude with this sentence. It's a real challenge, you know, to address all of the issues that have been raised and pose a coherent question. But I think the key thing is class independence. Not people's war, but working class struggle, workers' councils, not populism, but class politics. That's what Marx stood for, that's what Rosa Luxemburg argued for, and that's what, you know, the classical revolutionary movement, anti-parliamentary movement, has argued for. Don't you agree?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so don't you agree?
To go pick up Rosa.
Go pick up Rosa. Yeah.
And her sister. So I apologize for that. Thank you very much, and good luck with your
So other questions were, what is our primary job as leftists? What are the reasons for success and failure? Quite blankly, what ideas are good? And I would add to that, are ideas in and of themselves like statically good, or do they actually have to have a context? What influence did the leaders of the working class have on the left's decline?
You looking at me?
I'm looking at whoever.
All right, maybe I'll start. I think I'm going to throw out my anarchist sectarianism here. There's that thing about the past like weighs like a nightmare on the mind of the president, right? It does. And we do have to learn things from the past, right? One thing that we learned is like organization, right? For another thing that we've learned is like open movements and underground movements, separation between those. Anarchists don't seem to have figured that one out. Bad anarchists. There's a lot of things we can learn from the past, but I think what the population, what people as a whole have learned, is that Leninist parties are not it. They're very suspicious of Leninist parties, and for very good reason. They're suspicious of democratic centralism, very hierarchically organized parties calling themselves Bolshevik, right? Like, or whatever, right? Like, these parties have, you know, on occasion taken power, and we haven't got communism, right? And in most cases, when these parties have taken power, good, solid, working-class communist class fighters like us all end up being fucking killed, right? Like that has been the history, right? So, and I think we do have to, like, think about other forms of organization that aren't, like, the Bolshevik Party, or a Bolshevik Party, that can possibly work. I think that, you know, while learning the lessons of those parties, like, for instance, having a tight membership, having weekly meetings, these things are really good. If you don't do that, like, you suck and you're never going to organize anything. So we should take, you know, some lessons, but people are very suspicious of Leninism, and for good reason. Also, people know when they're not being included. People know when their voices aren't really being heard and when they don't really have a voice in that movement. And you get this sometimes with sort of front groups, sort of like mass line front groups, or, you know, most of the leftist organizations in which there isn't really any democracy. Any of the sort of NGOs or OTAP or Notice of Legal or any of these sort of things, these are not things that people can join and sort of have their voice heard, largely. On the other hand, right, like, at least Maoists can point to, like, actual revolutions going on in the world and, like, actual populations of people who are, like, you know, fighting for things, right? Anarchism isn't that relevant. I mean, there's a pamphlet, like, the international relevance of platformism, right, which is just a freaking joke. It's ridiculous, right? So, I mean, there's that, too. Anyway.
Can I, because, you know, I understand there is quite a suspicion around Leninist parties, but this we have to place in the context of the history of the global international communist movements. So what in history, what are the groups that have actually contested state power, that have actually organized itself? Now, what happened afterwards, the restoration of capital, the restoration of inequality, these are things that in a scientific approach, we find that, okay, Lenin made an advance on Marx. He was able to synthesize Marx's ideas and to develop an actual strategy and tactics to rally not only the workers, because you have to remember the working class in Russia prior to 1905 was significantly smaller. And what I think what's lacking in the general discussion here is the lack of focus on the mode of production and how that relates into social relations. So in that sense, Mao afterwards, like during the period of post-World War II, we have like the proliferation of national liberation struggles. And how did those struggles organize themselves? They were based on a Leninist model of a vanguard party. In the Erfurtian program, it's designed, like, you know, even Kautsky himself, who was the progenitor of Marxism, said that you have to merge socialism with the working class movement. Working class movement is not the same as, like, the revolutionary proletariat class. It requires some sense of mobilization, ideas that will grip the minds of the masses. And what Mao does, I think, is advance that by going to the people. And he advances proletarian science in the fact that he comes up with the actual strategy of, you know, a military political strategy of how to defeat the enemy. How are we going to do this when they have everything and we have nothing? And if you place it in the context of the stage of imperialism as it is now, most of these revolutionary movements are occurring through the strategy of people's war that have actually, as a lightning strike, politicized people and revolutionized them.
I'm going to just interject here, maybe to touch off of a point that mm-hmm. Megan raised mm-hmm. and something that you raised, I guess, before the panel began.
Can I just say one, this is the
sure.
last point that I really need to get out there,
go
is
for
that
it.
This emphasis on a working class struggle or on, you know, mobilizing the working classes, this is, we have to look at, the concept of uneven capitalist development, right? And so in the sense that when we there were disastrous policies in the past ordered by the Comintern to these semi-feudal, semi-colonial, or semi-feudal countries that were disastrous because it didn't take the lessons and apply them to the concrete conditions of any particular country. And so the dismissal of a Leninist party is like, fine, we can dismiss this here on, you know, we've reached a certain level of industrial production, we're now in like a very high level of imperialist decline, I would say. But people in other parts of the world are actually galvanized by Marx, by Leninism, by Maoism. And they are the only ones that were able to produce, like we're talking about revolutions here, an abrupt replacement of one class by another. No other spontaneous movements have been able to achieve that. If there was one that came up, well, you know, maybe I will call it a day and put my Leninist politics in the drawer.
I guess maybe just to add into kind of the list of questions, so how, with that being potentially true, do you deal with like the very real aversion to this sort of politics that Magnus brought up? Because I don't think that that's an invalid point at all.
No,
most of the people at Occupy or most of the people in the G20 are not like, you know, amped up to join a Leninist party.
I think this goes back to what Barry was saying before, was like what is the leadership of these working class movements? What are they doing? Like, what are they teaching? You know, like, right now we have a very declawed, defanged, domesticated working class. If you look at the heads of the trade unions, the heads of the labor movements, they're making all kinds of, and in fact, I'm kind of sorry that Jim left because I wanted to ask him about Buzz Hargrove and the 2007 Magna deal. But on top of that, you know, you have Buzz Hargrove backing the liberal candidate. So in this sense, we have to ask, like, okay, like, is this working class movement enough? Again, what I mentioned in my presentation is that there's always going to be forces if we don't have a sophisticated analysis of the stratification of class within Canada, because there are layers. It's not, the working class is not a homogenous entity. There are stratifications within it. And for us, like, that's what the PCR program refers to as the hardcore of the proletariat. They're the ones whose immiscerations are multiplying thousandfold, let's just say. It's becoming increasingly harder to get by. We cannot, you know, people can't pay their rent. They're relying on food shelter, like the food banks.
I'm going to ask Claire or Cam if they have anything to kind of contribute to these questions.
I think we should. I think we could get another round of questions. People have
Claire, can I just? I have a couple thoughts that are kind of pertain directly to things you both said, and I think it's important, and like almost a whole different conversation about what it would mean to, like, what it means to conceive of effective revolutionary anti-imperialist struggle from the North American position.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I think the RSM has been having those conversations internally. I feel like this event was organized, and maybe my impression, I have a different impression, was organized mainly around the concept of resistance, though.
Mm-hmm.
So the focus on the reform versus revolutionary, I think I understand that to be somewhat beside the point, although it's obviously generative. And I want to go back to what Josh said, because I think it's really significant and builds on your point about the fact that, like, the Occupy movement is so popular. Like, people are really, like, there's a lot of appeal to what we might call, like, a cultural anarchism. And that is part of the terrain of struggle, and communists should be thinking about it. And not just strategically, but also in terms of where the similarities lie with respect to strategy. So the fact, like, your, you know, differentiation between the Black Bloc and the Red Bloc is important, I think, on the ground. But it's actually the same, they encounter the exact same challenge when they get the fucking fence down and don't want to go past and get fucking shot. Like, nobody knows what to do about that limit situation. And it's kind of, I think, important ground, like, spending a lot of time disavowing one or another interpretations of history or orientations to activist practice, I think, causes us maybe to, you know, it can be useful and it can be good exercises, but causes us maybe a little bit to lose ground, to lose some sight on priorities. And I appreciated particularly this event because it was like, okay, what is this thing, resistance, that we all fucking get collapsed into?
Okay, Dan,
mm-hmm.
Next
up.
I wanted to follow up on your question about how you pull people, how you pull apart the working class, not getting into segments, but the part of the working class that has a more of a right politics, how you can pull them to the left
want to follow up on it, because I think Jim's answer was totally inadequate. His answer being that you find people from footwork and politics, you work them with them on a particular issue, and then you help them expand their consciousness about how that's related to other things and how that's related to the revolution. I think that's inadequate because it hardly wanted to write politics. So that working class guy takes a stand on anti-abortion. You're not going to move that side to the left to revolution. If that's evident to you, then we have to ask, somebody takes a stand on environment, are you necessarily going to bring that side to the left? The guy takes a stand on higher wages, you're not necessarily going to pull them to the left. So I want to let the question stay at how you move right working class to the left.
Thank you very much. Next, I had Joseph.
A couple of times I've heard several different people on the panel describe the strength of Occupy, using that expression, and also I think you just said it was really popular. And, you know, Toronto is a city of several million people. We're talking about a couple hundred people in the park and a couple thousand on the marches, and that's, you know, that's not very good. And I guess my question is, why do you think the left is just so bad and horrible at changing minds and convincing people? Like, you take the idea, like, you're a human being, you have worth, you have value. You know, that's pretty popular. It's hard to screw that up, you know? And my question would be, do you think, like, has anyone maybe some of the behavior, some of the language that might put someone off from joining a movement, has anyone experienced it? Maybe this evening?
Okay,
then
I have up next, Peter. Peter's still here.
Oh.
Yeah, you are. So,
I guess the question is about Lynn, you were talking about as a Leninist, as a Maoist, how important history is. And I must admit, I was a little surprised that there's a Maoist group in Toronto. And I'm just curious, back in the history, the 70s and so on, there's lots of Maoist groups in Toronto. You had some against nationalism, some for nationalism, some with significant factory cells in workplaces, some even elected president of their local. But they all kind of mess it up. I mean, by the time they sort of unraveled, there was, it seemed that their democratic centralism wasn't too democratic. They had a number of positions that today we might find odious as far as, the homosexuals being eliminated
with
capitalism or any form of feminism dividing the working class. I mean, what are your, so as I say, in my impression, I don't think, not that I'm keen on Maoism elsewhere, but I don't think they were at all successful in translating it here. So I'm curious, what lessons have you learned from all those groups that were operating here in Toronto?
Okay, I was just going to, you'd raise your hand as well.
I'll wait for the panel to respond to that.
Okay, wonderful. So just to kind of recap, to address the right aspect of the working class and the adequacy of just thinking through kind of the progressive push that might not actually end up being a progressive push, for you guys to actually reconsider what you mean by the strength of Occupy, to wonder why the left is so horrible. I want people to push people off about it. Actually, I wanted to add to that. No, I agree with you. Don't worry. It's something that Megan brought up earlier when she was talking about kind of like who's drawn to Occupy. Like, how do you deal with the antisocial element that's drawn towards something that's, apparently leftist? So you have, Nazis that are coming to Occupy. Like, how do you deal, right? And where did Maoism go wrong? Pam, since you haven't talked about
it. Yeah, I haven't said anything yet. I'm hoping maybe I can simultaneously address Joe's question and Dan's question about why the left is unpopular and why the right is popular among many working class people and how you deal with that. I can't say authoritatively how you deal with that, but I can raise the question of the right has reclaimed the concept of freedom. Like, libertarian politics no longer really exists on the left. Even the anarchist left tends to argue in favor of all sorts of personal lifestyle regulation in one way or another. I think something that really does alienate working class people from the left is the fact that it is not associated with personal freedom anymore. And, when it comes down to it, that was one of the fundamental points of Marxism. it's individual freedom. So.
Yeah, regarding the strength of Occupy, yes, I mean, of course, it's pathetic that we're celebrating these, like, tiny, stupid protests, right? But, like, you have to look at Occupy as not just the people in the park, and this is the problem, especially when you're in the park, you get really myopic and you can't see outside of the park, like, kind of literally, because you're stuck in the fucking park. The people in the park were supported by, like, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of other people, most of whom never showed up, right? This is why the cops couldn't clear out Occupy. Like if normally we set up a tent city and the cops are there, right there, smashing heads in and whatever, right? They never did that with Occupy, right? Why? Because of massive public support. So you have to think about the sort of massive support of the, like, pretty passive, stupid Canadian population that is generally not active in politics, which has been a failure, I think, of, like, whatever, Labour leaders, NDP, whatever. Why is the left horrible? I used to be in the army. I quit the army because I realized that imperialism was wrong. So having come to this conclusion that imperialism was wrong, I quit my job and my whole life and left all my social circles and everything. And it took me 5 fucking years to find a left from there, right? It took a long fucking time. I couldn't find it. And when I did find it, I thought it was stupid. A lot of the left was pacifist. I wasn't a pacifist. I still think pacifism is, like, dumb. Anyway, and then with the antisocial element, like, it takes a long time, and we're, like, pretty unsuccessful, I think, and we're really good at turning people off, and it seems like sometimes people only join the left because they date someone who's in the left, right? Obviously, we can't grow on that basis. And then we have, how do you deal with the antisocial element at Occupy? Well, there's only one way to deal with Nazis, and that's to beat them up. There's no other way to deal with Nazis, right? But the problem is that people at Occupy were against beating up Nazis, right? Or even kicking them out in a pseudo-violent sense, right? Even in a, like, pushing, yelling kind of sense. So what we kind of had to do was, like, beat them up when people weren't, like, we didn't actually beat them up, but I squandered, like, a lot of my political capital at Occupy by, like, kicking out Nazis and being like, no, fuck you, like, being very, like, taking a very, like, sort of confrontational approach with Nazis or other kinds of antisocial elements, and because of that, I lost a lot of social capital at Occupy, but I think it was worth it. Anyway, that's it.
Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think the question of, like, why are we so horrible at changing minds is one of the most important ones. And my answer, although it's really hard to, like, substantiate in much detail, and I hope it will resonate a bit, I'll try and think of, like, really clear examples, is that we emphasize content over method quite often, and to a quite significant degree. So I think about, again, like, new activists coming in. We're very quick to provide explanations for things, and sometimes that's very valuable, and it's very important that we rehearse that and become good at it. But I think our method, like, at an individual and at the kind of movement level, is our most important strength. And we don't talk about it in detail, and my personal opinion is that the main thing we should be talking about is the value of imminent critique. That is helping, through discussion at many different scales, reveal the desire for freedom that is the biggest potential in our society for revolution, that people do feel really strong desires for freedom. And it's actually, you know, of course, it's mainly experienced through commodity in the society, but nonetheless arises all the time. And I think it's specifically that desire, which is really undeveloped, isn't about political history, isn't attuned to, like, legacies of revolutionary struggle at all, but it's specifically that desire and the promise of that desire that compels people to get involved with Occupy and that compels people to get involved with the anti-globalization movement. And I feel like maybe that's the way to kind of respond to your question, like, why do we give a shit about this thing? Like, I have a very hard time entertaining claims that it wasn't significant and isn't significant now. It's fucking huge. In Toronto, the movement, the like, mobilizations might have been small, but you don't even have to say, like, but there were these thousands of people who didn't, you know, who weren't there. It's like, this thing...
When 2008 happened and the housing bubble burst, the whole world should have changed. And it didn't, because there was no organized or relevant left. And I think that shows how kind of impotent the movements are.
Oh, my God, I'm not suggesting otherwise. I'm not saying, I'm not saying Occupy is a promise. I'm saying this thing is a reflection of the fact that there is something in our society, and I think that it appeals to a lot of people, and that, like, us taking it seriously is part of saying, like, okay, if we engage in imminent critique, like, if we can take anything we encounter in society and, like, try to find the morsel of promise in it, then our challenge is setting priorities and saying, where is the greatest promise? And I think there was huge promise in the Occupy movement because it mobilized so many people with such passion, even though it wasn't, like, cultivated analysis, and you feature that a lot.
Okay, and then Ellen?
Yeah, I just wanted to address your question about, like, you know, you're surprised at the newfound interest in Maoism. Actually, it's a growing kind of movement, not just here, but in imperialist countries. Like in Italy, there's, like, in fact, two Maoist parties. In France, which is the progenitor of the Maoist movement in imperialist countries in the 1960s. But what I wanted to touch upon is what the Americans call, within the 1970s, the new communist movement. So this you see in the 70s, a rise of ML movements as a result of the struggle between the Soviet path and the Chinese path. And so the Chinese path brought the Maoist, waged a critique against the Soviet revisionism of peaceful transition to socialism. It's interesting because we do have a history of Maoism in Canada that I don't know if many people are familiar with, but two organizations located in Quebec, the En Lutte, which commanded a membership of about 2,000, and the WCP, which is the Workers' Communist Party, which had upwards of about 6,000 members and sympathizers altogether. They had sent organizers into Ontario, you're right, into factory cells, into neighborhood committees to try and organize a Maoist movement. My take on this is that these were basically Maoist parties on paper, but where they didn't have any concrete actions or any concrete, like, new tactics to breathe life into waging a Maoist sort of struggle against capitalism in imperialist countries. So what I would say now is, like, we have to think about the tactics that were employed in the 60s, how that failed. You have the groups like the Red Brigades in Italy, the Red Army faction, the Weather Underground. These were essentially Maoist-inspired but Foucaultist, because they didn't bind themselves to the masses, as they should have, being proper, if they were going to be proper Maoist parties. Now we see in 84 with the burning of the ballot boxes of the Shining Path. Was that in 80? Yeah, that was in 80. The RIM was formed in 84. So when there's actually a fighting communist movement on the ground, that is what politicizes people. The fact that we don't have that here, well, the question is, well, how do we build it? So it's not just a matter of waiting for objective conditions to magically appear, because we can infinitely defer that movement. But it's an alignment of the subjective understanding or the subjective conditions with the objective conditions that will produce situations where, in the context of organization, we can proceed to the next step in the struggle. I mean, like, there's a theory of protracted people's war that would kind of explain how that goes.
Okay.
I'll leave it there.
I'm going to ask for, like, one final round of questions, and then those final comments that you guys would make will be your final comments as well, if that makes sense.
Okay,
sure.
Actually, I'm
going to
pass now,
because
I was
going to
comment on it
later.
So, okay.
It's
much better than
that. In the back? Question, primarily I would start with colleagues. I'm interested. You brought up the whole international aspect of success for Leninist or Maoist parties.
Mm-hmm.
I can't go very international, but if I talk about the region where I originally come from, South Asia, what a level of success has been achieved by communist Maoist parties with Nepal, India, West Bengal primarily for a long time. A lot of it initially involved a lot of promise, and one of the major things that they were successful in, and something that we are sort of downplaying, is that reform, because it was all around land reform. Once the parties became parties that took power, they all appeared to be opportunist Tatars who were trying to control mm-hmm. people's lives. Places in West Bengal was as bad as people in villages couldn't get married mm-hmm. without their, like, you know, getting permission from mm-hmm. the party leaders, kind of thing. So mm-hmm. it was control at that level. So I wonder mm-hmm. what that means in terms of, like, the international success. I'm not saying that this mm-hmm. is emblematic of success everywhere, but there's a level of control that was successful. Specifically as time went on in terms of the promise that these mm-hmm. movements seemed to have when it was burgeoning.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of want to size with the rest of the panel a little bit mm-hmm. in terms of something, I forget your name.
Cam
brought up the issue of freedom, and it sort of ties to the point of something that the right does really well and the left can't do in terms of convincing. One of the things that the left right seems to constantly be able to convince people of is they have a place to go where they're free and feel safe. What the left constantly promotes to people is you have value, but what you have to do is struggle, and, you know, it's a fight and it's not going to pay back. Right, whether it's through, like, you know, it's different small community groups, it's religious houses, whatever it promotes safety and seems to attract a lot more people, while the left, its convincing value is there's a fight out there and you need to go fight. We don't know whether you're going to win. So I wonder how you guys see that aspect of the play in terms of what freedom really means, and how can the left become something that convinces people in a sort of, I don't know, makes it, well, convinces people. I'll leave it at that.
Are there any other questions? I'm going to go with you here, and then in the back.
Actually, it was more just a comment on the freedom.
Okay. Do you want to add that on so that way I can have it as be kind of like an amendment to the question?
I was just going to note that I think that something further in the freedom question is this idea of safety is that the left historically can provide safety in a way of providing non-freedom to oppressors or people like that, and that other people can feel more safe in that, like when what the left has done, but that I think the problem of why people are suspicious of the Leninist Party is that freedom, that then it becomes sort of, it starts to feel that edges onto them and not just onto former oppressors. I was saying that the sort of freedom, safety,
issues. Okay.
Hi, my name's Neil, and I also marched on those cruise missiles. I was in high school, but I'm also part of I work in a magazine called International's Perspective, and it's a collective. But what I like here, it was nice to see different points of view, quite radically different points of view. I'm not really sure I agree with any of you on everything, but that's probably a good thing. But what I was a little disappointed by was that my understanding was that we were talking about resistance and looking forward, and it seemed to be, we spent a lot of time looking back on, we talked about the right combination of maybe Trotsky or Mao or Meinhof or these things, and it seems to me that I don't want to rubbish the past, to simply say what's old should be forgotten. That's obviously not true. But we need to look forward, and we also need to understand what's changed since those people wrote. And many of the contributions of Marx and Mao and possibly even were important, did write things which were important, but we're not in those days. The days have changed, and we need to understand, I think, the way that our society of capitalism has changed. The term that we've often used in the organization I'm part of is decadence, this sort of cannibalism of the 20th century. That as capitalism has grown, it's mm-hmm. also become more horrific, more barbarous, mm-hmm. more genocidal. It also alienates us much greater. We're pushed further apart. Maybe this is some of the reasons why we're unable to connect even as human beings, except in very exceptional circumstances. And it's unfortunate Jim is gone. I think reformism, what it does is it tends to suggest in a way that we can make things better. Better for us, perhaps, but not better for maybe the mass of humanity. and I think this whole horrible stinking system mm-hmm. is a part and parcel and has to go, whole cop, not mm-hmm. the whole thing. Reformism leads back into that, I guess. My last point, and maybe I'll ask you to comment on this, because it's been about resistance. I think that on everyday level, existence is resistance. Whether it's on a macro level, sure, most of the time. Not always, sometimes we get ground under. But on a much larger level, too, at times. And perhaps that's, I think, I won't say I was very occupied, very active in Occupy. I wasn't, I won't make that claim. I went to somebody around this. But that opens a possibility of discussion of radical change. And it doesn't always work, doesn't often work. But I think that's the possibility that we strive for when we come here, about creating that human community. Wouldn't you agree?
Okay. That question about the existence of the left versus the even sadder reality of its extinction to deal with. How do we deal with the present rather than just looking at the past? Trying to understand the history of authoritarianism and how the curtailing of freedom by both the left and the right has had an impact on people's conception of the left. And I guess I wanted to end also with what Claire brought up with Sartre's formulation, so the idea of the rebel and the revolutionary, and how could we be assured that we are the latter, or could even those of us wearing revolutionary clothes be rebels in disguise? So maybe we'll just go down the line this time, since everyone
can
should
I
have
go first.
Or
do
you want to go last?
Can I go second?
Sure. Is anyone prepared to go first?
Can you repeat the question, please? Sorry, I'm
no, because I just want to So to try to deal with the history of authoritarianism on both the left and the right, and how that's had an impact on how people view the left, how we would deal with the present, and not just looking to the past, and I would say probably adding on to that, not just applying methods of the past onto the present, because the present is different. The hope of the existence of the left versus the despair of its extinction, and then kind of ending on the Sartre formulation of the rebel and the revolutionary and how we can be assured that we are the latter and not the former. Any takers?
Right. Oh. So, like, I don't know, we're talking about left, freedom, safety, alienation, right? Lenin is baiting aside. We need organizations, right? We need organizations, and I'm not arguing at all for an organization. I'm maybe making an argument against a Bolshevik party, but like, organizations are fucking critical, right? And we have no safety but what we make for ourselves. We have no safety but what we organize to take, and that can be in a very sort of like having each other's backs in the streets, right? In that sense, or as workers, you know, like being able to actually threaten to like go on strike and actually do stuff, right? Or women's movement, which I've never even seen a women's movement. I heard there was one once. But if we're not organized as women, we're going to lose, you know, any rights which we've gotten, right? Like, paper shields aren't worth anything. Like, sort of direct action gets the goods, and we have to organize to do anything, right? And that's how we get safety and freedom, sort of simultaneously, right? And I think we shouldn't be seduced by safety, and that's a passive reformism, right? Like, revolutionaries, it's not about being safe, right? Because being safe is what's going to destroy, like, and always taking the safe path, that's just going to destroy us. And I think that's why the left is, in some ways, irrelevant, right? Because we always, we're taking the safe route, and that's not the route towards change. And then also, like to think about, to actually look at, I really liked your point about, I think you made this point too, actually looking about at our society as it exists, right? And I think, like, Gramsci, like, has like a lot of points on this. Like, go out, like, look at your fucking society, right? Look at the structures that exist in your society. You know, learn from the past, but learn about the present. We don't do that enough. And I mean, revolution and organization, these are sort of the answers to capitalist alienation. And I think when we actually organize, you know, and we actually organize for revolution, that's when people will come to us out of their sort of alienated lives, right? When we build something that's worth coming to.
Well, first of all, I think this has actually been really interesting. I'm like sitting here like, what the fuck do I think? So that's good. I appreciate it very much, and I appreciate everybody's contributions. I think the left has made a mistake in interpreting the power of the right and its mobilizing potential in focusing too much on what I think in left terms and in right terms, coincidentally, is called community. And actually, Megan and I are speaking on a panel, a critique of community as an activist concept at Left Forum on Saturday, if anybody's making that trek. I think that the thing that science, that kind of brings people on the right together or compels people towards grassroots right politics is actually anger. It's real frustration with their lives and with the lack of power they have, and a desire for some self-control and some form of it. So safety figures in, but I do think we maybe, and I don't actually think that that safety is categorically reactionary or something, but I do feel like the emphasis on it actually misinterprets the values of the right. And the right's most effective mobilizing around anger and all this stuff, and getting to people's kind of that, again, that potential in everybody, I think is a left thing. Like I think the right kind of took our best shit, and we forgot how to use it. So how was I going to connect this? So then I think this, you know, this gets this actually pertains to conceptions of resistance and why that is the kind of most motivating or the kind of the language we use or activists use today. And it specifically pertains to the kind of existence of resistance claims. So like when struggles, and of course this varies according to all kinds of things, when it feels like such an unbelievably difficult struggle to get through a day, it's, I think, useful to say, like to be generating cultures of recognition of that. And the problem is we can't, like the existence as resistance thing, I don't know if you were saying that in a kind of celebratory gesture, but the problem is that we don't talk very often about the limits of those politics, and I understand that to be the point of today. And if existence is resistance, that is, like if resistance is every day, then it's certainly different from revolutionary politics, because if everything is revolution, then nothing is revolution, right? So I guess there's so much to say, but that's what I'm going to say.
Yeah, I'd just like to consider a couple things. Again, thanks, Claire. You know, just the idea that resistance is the fundamental thing we can do, I think, indicates the very low horizons that we've set for ourselves in terms of where we're at now. And I think that would be tied into one of the things that we kind of talked about in the comments tonight, that, like, the left is out of touch with people, which seems so obvious. Like, this is something that has essentially become a subculture. And as much about the social support of individuals as about its earlier intent, which is overcoming capitalism. And just to talk a little bit about authoritarianism, I think what Neil said is very true, and how authoritarian brutality in the West is tied in with the decadence of this overripe, you know, capitalism as being overripe for revolution and being an imperialist and Bonapartist system. But just because Belen has been so forceful about advocating for Maoism tonight, I would feel bad if I didn't mention the authoritarianism that has come with these national liberation movements and as modernizing projects in the Third World. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't mention that all of these have ended in failure at one point or another. Mm-hmm. And I think you're confronted by the question of whether these end in failure just because of crises of leadership or opportunistic elements, mm-hmm. or if they end in failure because they're conducted on a national level, as in this, like the Soviet Union failed because an international revolution got turned into a national revolution by the isolation of the Soviet Union by the imperialist countries and by the failures of revolutions in the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's a long, lots of stuff to consider. I guess just addressing the authoritarianism that comes, that what we've seen in the actual socialist societies, this is a problem of the party, that any, like, we need to look where we want to get to, right? And so the party has been an instrument and a tool to get us further to that goal, but unfortunately when you have the class struggle just doesn't end as soon as you have the revolution. Once you take over the reins of the state, you're going to be confronting with a new set of problems. And in terms of the national liberation that you said that this is what I guess Frantz Fanon addressed in his book, The Wretched of the Earth, is like, how is it that you have national liberation struggles? How are they mobilized? Are they mobilized on just a nationalist agenda or on a socialist agenda? But, you know, you have to, because, again, I point to uneven development, that we cannot wait for, you know, to say that not to fight for national liberation struggles is to consign people to live in misery under the yoke of imperialism, under the brutality of these, the comprador classes that sell out their people in their countries. What you have to do is push the class struggle. You push it, but you have to know where you want to go and then develop the appropriate tactics to get there. Whether, you know, in my experience, I haven't felt, I'm just going to say that there is line struggles within parties. So it's not necessarily that what you see outside is this big authoritarian, everybody's yoked to the same lines. But when in parties, there are multiple factions that compete. But again, because you have to kind of treat these things dialectically, how much democracy can you have? And when you're in a fight with your enemy, how much do you have to centralize the line and to develop the appropriate tactics in accordance with that line? I think we met before, maybe. I'm having memories of you at the Anarchist Book Fair 1 year. Yes, I have your journal, the internet. Yes. And we talked about Gorder and Pankook. Good luck, communists. So I guess I would just maybe end on that, is like, what's absent, like what I find absent is that propeller of the class struggle, and it doesn't end just when you yank it's based on your our understanding of the relationship to the state. Ideally, you want to push communism to a point where there would no longer be classes inequality. This is one method of getting there. This is one method in the past that has shown to be effective. It's also shown to have issues, right, that we need to address. I mean, this is a contemporary problem for, again, just to go back to Josh's point, it's like, what do we learn from these successes? What do we learn from these failures? And, like, there has been a lot of study, I think, on in terms of catching the right line. Like, the Soviet had a particularly bad line in advancing the class struggle after the seizure of power. Mao tried to address that. But, again, like, the restoration of bourgeois forces. You get a proliferation of a new people from ostensibly good class backgrounds during the Cultural Revolution became the new elite. So we need to explain, how does this happen and how do we prevent that from reestablishing itself?
Okay, I would like to thank all the panelists and the audience for being wonderful. If you want to be involved in planning events like this in the future, you can talk to Cam or myself. And I think we'll go to the Regal Beagle for some brewskis afterwards if people want to keep talking. But thank you very much.
Thank you for the organizers.
Really I didn't feel like in a five to seven minute presentation I could address reform, revolution, resistance, and then say anything about Occupy. That's why I didn't. But and also because I think I disagree with you about resistance, right? But like,
yeah.
I didn't even like. I could address that disagreement, but then I wouldn't say anything else on it, right? Like,
yeah.
Yes.
Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It went really well.
Very.
Yeah, but I don't know.
Very good. Really good when everyone's ready to kind of test.
Oh, it's probably kind of...